You're listening to the Inform and Connect podcast, a production of the American Foundation for the Blind. To learn more about AFB, visit our website at www.afb.org. And now your host, Melody Goodspeed.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Inform and Connect podcast of the American Foundation for the Blind. We are so excited to have you here as usual. I'm here with Tony.
Hello.
We have a lot of burning questions today for our guest, so we kind of want to hop right in, right, Tony?
Most definitely. I'm ready to nerd out on all things blindness today.
I am ready to nerd out on all things as well. We are so excited to have the author of The Country of the Blind, Andrew Leland, with us today. Hey, Andrew, how are you doing?
Hey, I'm good. How are you?
We are super fantastic. We're so excited to have you here with us today on this podcast.
Wow. I'm happy to be here. I'm excited to nerd out on all things blindness. It's a three-way blind convention or something like that.
It seems like you would be, a question would be, and so for folks that don't know, so The Country of the Blind, a memoir at the end of sight. Love those colons or the
yes, book. Yes. Forgot about the colons.
Through Penguin Press Random House Books, right?
Yep.
And it's gained a lot of attention. This is hands down one of the more mainstream accepted books of a memoir on blindness. We get a lot of, obviously, whenever someone writes a memoir telling story, their experience overcoming challenges with blindness. But you've done something new, which has been fantastic. And it's just been, I had a chance to listen to it on Audible. I paid for it very much. I enjoyed that.
So did I. I'm in the middle of it. Yes. Yeah. But, and I also want to add that Tony has burning questions here for you.
Whoa.
But well, the first burning one is coming now. I know.
Because in the memoir, it's a great book. we'll have a link to it in the podcast description for folks to the Penguin page for the book. But, I've also been a nerd for audio engineering over the decades. And listening to the audiobook on Audible, well done, sir.
Yes.
Here's a question. The first question out of the gate.
Yeah.
As you share openly about, the experience of learning Braille and the challenges of adapting with just reading and everything like that. But you did an excellent job narrating your own book. And I'm dying to know how that experience was like.
Yeah, well, you're pretty flawless.
Man, thank you guys. I mean, first of all, I've had a lot of experience. I worked in radio and so I've had a lot of experience reading scripts aloud and stuff like that. But I definitely felt like a fraud throughout the process of writing this book. And even just after publication, because I have a bunch of residual vision that I still use to look at all kinds of stuff, even as I increasingly identify as blind and experience life as a blind person. And that kind of was very pronounced during the audiobook process, because what I decided to do was I had to OCR my own book, because the only, at that point in the, it hadn't come out yet. There wasn't like a Kindle version or whatever I could download or Bookshare. But so the only version that sort of existed with all the final corrections was a PDF that was not super accessible. And so I like OCR'd my own book, which I thought was funny, using Kurzweil. And then I reflowed it into a typeface that I found, that I heard about really just like a couple of weeks before I had to do the recording through the Braille Institute in LA. They released this font called Atkinson Hyper Legible that is designed for low vision readers. And I found it really effective. I like it a lot. And it basically like helps distinguish letter forms that are often confused in normal fonts. And I cranked it up to probably 30 point type and zoomed it in. But when I was that big, white text on a black background, but when it was under those conditions on my laptop screen, I could really only see like half a sentence at a time. So I was like, well, this is fine. If I like scroll constantly, I'll be able to read fluidly. And then I got into this fancy New York recording studio where Penguin had booked me for a couple of days to record it. And like 10 seconds in, the engineer said, oh, actually we're picking up the sound of your finger on the trackpad scrolling. You can't be scrolling and speaking at the same time. And I was like, well, then I'm doomed, because I don't know how else I'm going to be able to do this. And they were like, no, it's fine. Just like pause at natural places and we'll stitch it together. And so it was really a matter of me being like, you know, I'm going blind as I write this. Scroll. It sounds less dramatic. It sounds more dramatic than it feels. Scroll. And, you know, like I basically felt like I was leaping from comma to comma, like a desperate person trying to cross a raging rapid or something, you know, just like they were like little lily pads in the river for me to rest on. And I was convinced it would sound terrible, but they're pros and they cut it together. And the other funny thing about that, just back to like my feeling of fraudulence is like, you know, I was like, oh, who do I think I am? Like writing a fancy book about blindness. And here I am like reading the print on my screen, not print, but whatever, reading the words on my screen. And then as I read the book to myself and like to the audiobook engineer, like so much of the book is about that feeling of in between and that sort of question of like, when am I no longer sighted? Like, when am I actually blind? That it was like soothing myself, you know? And it was like, I'd written the exact book to like reassure myself that I was not a fraud and that like, you know, what I was dealing with was indeed part of the world of blindness. And that includes like reading a book out loud in 30-point type.
Well, one of the great things in the book that you talk about and, you know, is throughout the experience about this, you know, you're very honest about this idea of feeling a fraud. And I think most people in the community, we remind ourselves, and you bring this up in the book, most of the community that we say are legally blind even have some sight, right? It's not the binary. And so, you know, excellent job in really presenting it as, you know, most people's experience is that the those that have no light perception is a very small number within the larger. I mean, it's a significant number. Don't get me wrong.
10%
or two. But yeah. So.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and I think I like, you know, that statistic is a really important one. I think, you know, the other thing that I encountered was just from talking to so many blind people, you know, going to conventions and so on, like that idea of the hierarchy of sight comes up a lot, I think, whether explicitly or just sort of implicitly in group situations where you've got like a range of different visual levels, but everybody there is blind. And for me, like the times when everybody just sort of can hang together as blind people, whether or not like one person's low vision and one person's no light perception and one person is acuity, you know, like there's something so powerful about the idea that like we can all be blind people together regardless of what the level of acuity is. And you don't have to throw like, well, actually I'm visually impaired or I'm legally blind or I'm low vision. And there's just something that I really love about the feeling of just being in community with blind people regardless of those distinctions. You know, not to say the distinctions are pointless. Like there are certainly times when using your usable vision, if you have it, makes sense. But I do want to push back against that feeling of hierarchy there, where like the low vision people are somehow like better off than the people with no light perception. And I think the way to do that is to sort of say, you know what, I'm blind and like you're blind and we can just both be blind and we don't have to obsess over the level of acuity that we might still retain.
Yeah.
You know, I'm so glad you brought that up. I literally just got back on Saturday from getting my third guide dog. And, you know, when you're working with so many people of different, you know, blindnesses, the spectrum, and we all worked together because we had a couple low vision, no vision like myself, and we all just sort of did it. And there was not that hierarchy. So, and we worked together. We were all shopping together and we just started laughing in the middle of the park. It's like, I'm pretty sure that no one else is having these discussions that we're having. You know, like that's just, I know. And it is so great. But no, I'm so glad that you brought that up.
I mean, the thing that I think is really important for me, and I hate to like call this person out. I wouldn't have to name them, but like, I remember there was one interview I did with a blind person who also has RP like me. And she was just telling me about how, like, you know, every year, every 10 years, she thinks to herself, I thought I was blind then, but I'm really blind now. Mm-hmm. And then she said something like, you know, but there's still people who, you know, she has like no light perception in one eye and basically like no acuity in the other, but like still has some light perception. And she was like, but there's some people who don't even have that. And I don't know how they manage. And I just thought to myself, like, wow, like if you're at that point in your vision loss journey, where like from where I'm sitting, like that is capital B blind, like, you know, that is that to me, that's you're on the other side of it. Like what I'm sort of obsessing over, like, you know, obsessively tracking every little loss. And I just thought to myself, like, I don't want to be, you know, I don't judge her. I sound like I'm judging her a lot, but like, I totally understand that impulse to like continually obsess over where you're at and mm-hmm. how useful it is. But also to me, it just felt so, so counter to where I wanted to be with blindness, to just sort of say like, well, you know, there, but for the grace of God, go I. Like, I don't know how they manage. Cause like, it feels so much more powerful to say like, no, we all are managing in different ways and, you know, we can all use some of the same skills. And so I think for me, like pushing back against that hierarchy and accepting, you know, and pushing back against my own feeling of fraudulence has to do with just with that desire to accept the condition as it is.
That goes into my burning question, actually. So thanks for segueing. You know, we talk a lot about I'm going to call it the blindness mechanics. I don't know if that's her terminology, but for me, I lost my eyesight very suddenly in my adulthood. You know, blindness was not in my wheelhouse. I lost it due to trauma and I'm totally blind. And I got a lot of that. Like, how are you going to function? How are you? And then, so I myself in turn, am asking myself, how am I going to function? And then I, to be honest with you, looked at it and said, okay, well, the spunky free spirited Melody is dead. And now I've got to be this person that's going to have to either be super cool, like, you know, Stevie Wonder, or I'm going to have to be nothing. There was no middle ground. And can we talk a little bit of like that emotional component? Because that's something that even now these days, I still kind of struggle with, you know, with all those things that you kind of brought up that we are battling. Like, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's such a good question. I've thought a lot about that. And, you know, like this book, the project of this book was really like, okay, I'm going blind. Like, there's no question about that. Like, RP is this gradual loss of sight. And I don't know when it's going to happen, but it's happening now and it's going to continue to happen. Like, what does that mean for me? Like, what kind of blind person should I be? And so I was asking that same question of like, is it Stevie Wonder or like, you know, living in mom's basement? Like, what are the options here? And like, what's the pathway to that goal that I want to reach? And the, you know, really explicitly, just I sought out cool blind people, you know, and that includes like, you know, whatever, like successful blind people, but also just like blind people who seem to be living lives like the one, not even like as blind people, but just like, who are the people that I'm already hanging out with that happen to be blind, you know? Mm-hmm. And the thing that I found in talking to them and like reading their accounts, like there's a woman I wish I had a chance to meet, but she died about 10 years ago, named Adrienne Ash, who was a professor at Wellesley and Yeshiva University and was a bioethicist. And she thought a lot about like disability rights and abortion and like prenatal selection. It's like really brilliant intellectual, and was blind from birth. And she, along with a lot of other people, has this really interesting argument where basically she's like, blindness, I mean, this is a very NFB argument too, right? Like, blindness is an incidental characteristic, but I really like, I found her example so powerful because she really embodied it, I think. And the idea is just that, you know, blindness largely for her didn't matter. And she really, I think, made a really convincing case for like, I am Adrienne Ash. I love music. I love, you know, hanging out with my friends. And like, blindness for her really only became an issue when she experienced depression, like when she applied for a job and they were like, I don't know how on earth a blind person would do this job, go away. You know, then blindness was an important part of her identity. But like, for huge swaths of her life, she was an intellectual. She was a professor. She was a classical music aficionado. And, you know, I think that's easier said than done. But I also think that like, when the rubber meets the road, like, it is possible to lead a life as a blind person in that way of just saying like, you know, yeah, it comes up. Obviously it's relevant in certain situations, but like, it does not need to be, as like the writer Elizabeth Sammons, said to me, like, blindness is not the main character in her life. Or there's another really lovely blind writer, Georgina Klieg, who said, on some days it matters less than the weather. And to me, like, that's sort of what I aspire to, I think. Like, it's an important part of my identity. And like, I'm obviously like super immersed in it now, like having written this book and going on podcasts and talking about it. But like, you know, at the end of the day, when I'm like eating dinner with my family, I'm not like blindly eating dinner, right? I'm not like blind man eating dinner. I'm just like hanging out with my wife and my kid and we're having fun. And I think that's where, what I aspire to.
That's a good place to be, I think, in a lot of sense. I mean, understanding that there's a reality for me, I've been legally blind since birth, but then went total when I was 15. And then 8 years later, they're able to get like a pinhole back that I don't really use, but it's still, you know, I'll take that over no light perception. But but it is, you know, that sense where I often feel it's a compliment when my friends forget that I can't see when I'm left in the parking lot going, guys.
Yes, I agree with this.
But, you know, I'm with my kids and it's just I'm their dad. And they'll stop and describe something that's going on or grab me if I'm about to plow into something. But there is that nice cruising altitude and a reminder too, that, I mean, even like going to parenting, cause you're a parent as well.
Yeah.
That's a hard job, right? Yes. Where it's, you know, life hands us these things that oftentimes are, you know, they maybe don't define us and are this sort of, you know, gadfly that constantly is nagging at us. But I mean, you know, there's still going to be bad days, even though you can say, oh, it's just incidental or it doesn't define me. You still get frustrated when you get on the wrong subway train and end up in the wrong part of town or, you know,
little
things like that. The same way that, you know, you get frustrated parenting when maybe you do something that you're like, oh, that was a dumb thing to tell my kid. What did I just, you know, what did I just malform in a child for future or something? But I mean, you know, it's a give and take, I feel like, in a sense.
Yeah, no, I definitely wrestled with that because I do think in both good and bad ways, it's not totally neutral. It's not totally incidental for me. And that, you know, I think even if I aspire to that, like, you know, it matters less than the weather condition, you know, like Adrienne Ash argued, there are times when it's going to be the source of oppression and then it becomes this sort of central part of your identity. And then on the flip side, I think there's like a really positive part to disability and blindness that you lose if you only dismiss it as like a neutral characteristic that has no bearing on who you are, which is to say, like, you know, when I'm hanging out in a room with like my friend Will Butler, for example, who lives in LA, who's like one of my favorite people, you know, like we're not just two guys hanging out. Like, it's definitely about blindness when we're like taking pleasure in talking about like the ableist thing some coworker said to us, you know, or like, you know, just some ridiculous story of getting lost in a bathroom or something, you know, like those, that feels like joy that comes directly out of this experience, which also gets lost if you try to dismiss it as like purely incidental.
It's great you mentioned joy because so AFB, we'll have a documentary that we're producing. We've been doing some private screenings right now, but it'll come up next year called Possibilities, which is kind of like looking at Helen Keller's life 100 years after she came to AFB in 1924 when she first came to AFB. And but it follows, you know, 33 people who are blind really in their experience and shows the diversity. But at the same time, it kind of taps into this identity that you know, we talk about in the documentary about blind joy. That, you know, I could be in Europe and there's going to be shared experiences that I know I'll be able to talk with someone, or in Latin America, wherever I may be, are the you know, getting lost in a bathroom or trying to find an Uber driver.
Yeah.
People really understand how tricky public restrooms are when you can't see. I just want to throw that out here right now. I mean, can we just, yes.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Yeah. Totally.
Thank you, well, that we're talking about bathrooms.
The last place you want to be putting your hands on everything.
I know.
It's kind of weird that this is coming up in the conversation about blind joy, but I also think that like the idea of joy is important because of the stigma around blindness, and like joy is the last thing that anybody would associate with the experience of blindness. But the reality is, you know, if you talk to 100 blind people, like you are going to have 100 stories of joy in their lives. You know, even very sad blind people are capable of finding it.
Well, and the ability to laugh it off. I mean, humor is such a great thing to have towards coping with anything in life. But
yeah,
those awkward experiences, knowing that, you know, like everybody loves tragedy in a sense in stories, and, you know, the old saying that, oh, well, someday you'll laugh about that. You actually can do that when you're with someone else.
Okay. Totally.
Yes.
Yeah. I think that I feel lucky that I've been like trained rigorously from a young age to find absurd humor in the suffering and the obnoxious difficulty of life.
Well, share a bit about as well, you know, talking about, you know, how well you've been able to navigate the world. But so much of that comes out of sort of where we come from and our identity sort of before we have to tackle this mountain that we're entering into with sight loss. And, you know, what was it that, you know, the fact that you come from, you know, a good tradition of mixing comedy and tragedy and humor from a writing perspective with your grandfather, who you talk about in the book, but also too, just your rich experience and being able to break things down as an editor, you know, for both print and podcasting, you know, what is it that you think has really helped lay the foundation towards being able to enter into this world to be able to navigate it with that sense of blind joy?
I mean, yeah. So you mentioned my grandfather, who is the playwright Neil Simon, who definitely was known for writing plays and movies that were comedies, but that had a lot of, you know, heart or emotion in them. And I think that that did, you know, trickle down to me through my mom, who's also a writer, you know, this idea of finding absurdity in situations, but also like, not just like finding absurdity to defang them or soften them, but really like pushing, like by burrowing into a difficult experience, like the joy and the hilarity and the comedy is in it, sort of inextricably bound up with the pain, you know, like the sort of pathos and the comedy are like, you know, geologically fused, like, you know, rocks kind of twisted together almost. And I write a lot about Samuel Beckett in the book kind of randomly, but it's not random because like Beckett, for my money, is like the best writer in all of literature at kind of identifying that both like terminally desperate and like, you know, gut bustingly funny and joyful blend. You know, my parents met in an ashram in India. And I think there's probably also some element of that in my approach to blindness, which is a similar, not a lot of people would mark out Samuel Beckett as a Buddhist, but I do think that there's something in the kind of like very straightforward confrontation with suffering and like with difficulty, but also like an ability to wear it very lightly and say like, okay, yeah, this is horrible, but also hilarious and maybe actually quite normal in the end.
And you do a great job of just in the book, walking through that sort of experience that you have and the identity that you had growing up and all the things that influenced you that really helped sort of, you know, carry you the way you did through this experience where a lot of people would probably just be shut in their basements, like you mentioned earlier, you know, sitting on their couch. I mean, here you are talking about Samuel Beckett and there's so much great history throughout this, from Oedipus Rex all the way to present day. You mentioned, you know, Francis Kessler's book, which is on our website. And what was the experience of just diving into this? Like it's a doctoral dissertation almost.
Yeah. I mean, that to me is part of the, you know, I think different people approach difficulty in their lives in different ways. And a friend of mine, how did he put it? He had a really great way of saying, I think he said something like, you and I both think with our hearts. Or was it feel with our brains? I forget which one he said, but you know, maybe it's six of one, half dozen of the other, which is to say that like, if there's something that is difficult in like an emotional way, approaching it intellectually, again, not as a way to be like, oh, I'm going to like put on my, you know, lab coat here and like make it not feel so bad, but actually to say like the way to understand this difficult experience is to understand it, you know, like to really like figure out what its component parts are. And, mm-hmm. you know, I use a metaphor early in the book that still resonates so powerfully with me, which is from when I was doing sleep shade training. I went to the Colorado Center for the Blind for about a month in researching the book, but also like so much of the book, it was like I was researching it, but it was also like getting blindness training as a blind guy. But sleep shade training, you know, and learning particularly like travel and cane training, you know, like you enter into a room, which is just like a constant experience at that center, right? Like, you know, they're like, okay, your next class is Braille, which is downstairs, go find it. You know, and then you're just like, all right, you know, it's a former YMCA. So it's just like these like wide carpeted halls where they're like twisting off into like twisty little passages all alike. And just that experience of like, what at first was this totally overwhelming, emotionally devastating, almost like feeling of being lost and like thinking I'm going towards the room and then finding like a brick wall that I had no idea was there. And just like, nobody's there. And I feel like I must look like an idiot, you know, all that very quickly gives way to just like, oh, like here's the Braille room. I found it. Like that experience is very similar to one of writing for me, you know, where you start out and it's like blindness is like this, you know, there's like 1,000 books and they all disagree with each other and you can't find them. And you know, it's just this very confusing, overwhelming experience to like, oh, you know what? Like, I've kind of mapped out some contours here. Yeah. And there is Frances Kessler's Unseen Minority, but then there's also like this new disability justice movement that, you know, really emerged, you know, decades after Kessler wrote, and, you know, and really trying to sort of like map out the territory until it feels, you know, more manageable. You can wrap your arms around it.
I think that's such a great lesson for everybody to learn when you are going through a hard time. You know, it's that's something I think is universal. And going back to people that, you know, in our blind community with such a high unemployment rate due to the fact that, you know, there are a lot of people that sit at home. I mean, I did that. It's the depression is real. The sadness and what you're saying, this overcoming is real. But I think getting curious about picking it apart and also saying to yourself, you know, life is just going to go on and I've got to either join it or sit here. And it's something that I think a lot of us struggle with. Can we talk about maybe how maybe that struggle of going into a club of disability that you don't necessarily want to go into, right? You don't join that one because you want to.
Right.
Is different from having, I mean, because life still works. Like all of us are parents in this little chat. All of us are, you have dealt with losses. All of us have dealt with normal life still happens. Can you kind of warn us like the difference between that? Because I think that is huge when it comes to like the psychological with depression and anxiety and all those things.
The difference between what? Between disability, the experience of becoming disabled and like a different.
Yes, like entering the disability club with something you don't want to be doing. I mean, who? It's not like everybody raises their hand. And although we are the most welcoming group.
Right. Yeah, no, that's an important. Yeah, I think that's a really important question. Because I do think that it's tempting to draw parallels between like disability and other identities, certainly like marginalized identities like race or gender or class. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's this really difficult difference, which is that, you know, disability almost seems to have inherent in it the idea of like a diminishment or a loss, you know, as opposed to like, you know, like certain, like, you know, like certain races have been historically painted in those terms, like to say, you know, this is, it's less, you know, it's a less desirable trait to have this, you know, racial marker or whatever, but like for disability, it almost seems foundational. It's like, well, obviously, right. It's like worse to be blind than sighted. And so, you know, like there was a really interesting writer. I think her name is Allison Kafer, who I quote in the book. She says, you know, I've found immense joy and like solidarity and community in disability, but like, that's not to say I want to become more disabled, you know? And so I think it's an important and kind of almost paradoxical feeling to be like, it's totally possible to embrace and celebrate disability. At the same time, like if you're being honest, like it's okay to be real about the fact that like you don't want to court more disability or like you wouldn't necessarily want to wish it upon loved ones or anything like that. And that, mm-hmm. that can be confusing, but I don't think it's actually a paradox. And I think, you know, it's something, it's kind of like what we were talking about earlier, where like you know, there are parts of it that are inconvenient and even worse than inconvenient, right? That can be profoundly frustrating and limiting and marginalizing, but those don't negate the parts that are joyful and normal. And it's sort of this, like the Jedi mind trick, I feel like, is you have to sort of be able to hold both at once and also accept the fact that some days you're on, you know, one side of the coin and some days you're on the other.
Oh, yes. 100%.
Yeah.
Well, back, you know, with that too, you know, dealing with, you know, that some days and realizing that like some days I call it, I'm having a blind day, which pretty much tells my friends and family, like, I can't take any big questions or big emotions today. I just can't. I'm going to do that Jedi mind trick. But, you know, we going back to when you went to, you know, the NFB training for, you know, a month and all of us have done this, right? Go through VR training.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we learn how to do it like it's a checklist. Okay, we're learning how to use a cane. We're learning from the Braille room. We're doing all this. But the emotional aspect is rarely talked about. The thing that I think we do need to do a lot of healing with, the, you know, the getting to that acceptance, because it is a loss, right? It's a change. Do you have any thoughts you can kind of put on that for people that are going through that?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. Like, you know, so I read a lot about the NFB in this book, in part because I just think as a writer, like they're incredibly fascinating. And like a lot of the sort of debates get sort of crystallized, you know, and I wish I had another 400 pages so I could write equally about ACB. And, you know, honestly, I didn't write so much about AFB because Francis Cussler did such an amazing job and that book exists already. Mm-hmm. You know, the interesting thing about the NFB is, and particularly the training centers that they have that I found, is that unlike my vocational rehab training that I got from the Mass Commission for the Blind, which didn't really have that emotional component, or if it did, it was like with a sort of frowning sighted person who was like, yes, like this is certainly difficult. Mm-hmm. You know, like at those NFB centers, I would say even more valuable than the like top-notch Braille instruction you're getting is like the off hours when you're like sitting in the apartments with, you know, 8 blind people of like radically different causes of their blindness, levels of blindness, backgrounds, but like you're all kind of, you know, some people who've like just lost their sight in trauma like 1 month earlier, to like people who've been blind from birth and are like really struggling to like find their way to a college, and just like being immersed in that world, it can be really challenging, but like nothing that I've experienced has been as powerful either in terms of like feeling like my experience is connected to other people's experiences. And, you know, those NFB centers aren't for everybody. And I, you know, I write about in the book, the sexual misconduct allegations, not allegations, you know, there's like well-documented sexual misconduct that have happened in those places. And also I think like a lot of ableism within blindness communities where like folks with multiple disabilities have had really tough times there, and like microaggressions, like racist microaggressions, all that stuff is very real. And definitely I would say like, it's not just like an automatic thing for anybody to go to, but I also think like the model of those, like the sort of core idea of those training centers, which is like get really competent blind people to teach other blind people how to do the basic stuff that you got to do to be successful. And then like let blind people hang out for long periods of time and like have philosophical discussions about ableism mm-hmm. and blindness. Like there's nothing that holds a candle to that for my money in terms of just like giving people, you know, and it doesn't have to be an NFB center, but like that model of just like hanging out with other blind people who like have kind of made it to the other side of like figuring out how to live their lives is just like, I can't recommend it enough for people who are thinking about how to do this.
That's a huge thing you bring up. Cause I, you know, I'm on my fourth guide dog and went to the CNI where I got mine from, and you know, you go away for 3 weeks, not a whole month, but
yeah.
But it is that experience of like, you know, we've got like CEOs of companies and we've got somebody that lost their sight like 2 years ago that's in college. And
yeah,
it was such an inspiration just to be around other people. And I know yeah. you mentioned the challenges with the Federation's, you know, centers. Look, they're a reflection of just society, you know. Mm-hmm, I'm an ex-Jesuit and we had our shares in the Catholic Church of reflecting society in mal ways.
Mm.
As well in you know the Catholic Church, but like just you know you can't escape society and all the goods and the bads that come with it no matter where you go, but yeah. but the huge strength or when I was 15 the I think the thing that instilled me that sense of just independence and knowing I can tackle the emotional side was I went to a camp for children who are blind, and it's just like being by so many other people that have had those different experiences and have kind of walked ahead of you, right? Like, it's kind of like, it is kind of like Jedi training school. You mentioned Jedis earlier.
No, I mean, like I went to
Jedi and they inspire you to get over your depression.
Totally. And, you know, and I think like the thing that really struck me about that training was I went there thinking I was going to be getting like, you know, a lightsaber and like, you know, ninja stars. And like, it was all about like the gear and like the skills and like, oh, okay, they're going to like show me how to like chop in a way where like, you know, I'll be able to chop onions just as fast as a sighted person. And like, they totally do teach techniques. Like, obviously, like there are basic techniques that you've got to learn, but like again and again, in every subject, whether it's, you know, tech, how to like figure out how to use a screen reader, or like cane training where they're just like dropping you off in downtown Denver and you have to find your way back. Like, it really is about attitude and confidence, and that you're like, okay, like this guy, Brian Bashan, said this quote that I like, I'm quoting him every day because it's so true and so powerful, where basically like it's about a belief in yourself to figure it out, and that like you can reframe it as a puzzle rather than as like, okay, I'm lost, I'm doomed, I look like an idiot, like this is horrible, to being like, okay, I know that there is a door in this room somewhere. How do I figure out where it is? Like, let's just like use logic and have take a deep breath and figure it out. And like again and again, that is the like the skill that I want to cultivate and that I return to way more than like, oh, if I have this type of cane tip, it resonates like in this way. You know, that stuff is important and fun, but it's really about like a faith in yourself to solve the problems that blindness tosses at you.
We need to figure out how to word all this stuff for our LinkedIn pages for employees. Yes. You know, I've heard you, Melody, talk about, you know, look, if you run across someone who's blind or has low vision, they've, you know, you've said it best where it's like they have, you know,
they have worked hard
to
get where they are. And, you know, I love the fact you're bringing that up in the sense of like, I like Tony, I mean, like I said, Rowan Chimperler just got back from blind school. Like Later Dog is where I get my dogs. Hmm. And that camaraderie that we had, like running around, I really use those 3 weeks away to say, okay, I need to get better at this, this, and this. And you can just get raw and vulnerable with these people. Mm-hmm. And I think that relationships really grow out of vulnerability. And I have learned, came back with so many, like, I want to be a faster typer on my iPhone. So a friend of mine gave me a link for something, how she talked. She was so wicked fast doing it. And I'm like, wow, that's impressive. Like, how do I do that? And I, you know, just that sharing is so important. And I love the fact of talking about like, you know, mental mapping. My strong suit is definitely not orientation. Like I get so like, even when I could see it, sometimes I would drive and be like, okay, I got to go back to my house and figure this out. But really sitting when you're working with your dog and just saying, okay, I've got to give this dog directions. Like I can't let this emotional of what is going on in my heart right now has got to take a back seat.
Yeah.
I think that if we all kind of, I mean, in the documentary, there's someone mentions, you know, we as blind people are the original life hackers, hashtag. But I think that's true. I mean, what you just said is pulling it down like, okay, you know what? There is a door here. I'm going to find it. It's fine. Yep. Everything is fine.
Yeah. Yeah. No. And I write about in the book, like the really literal hacker, not literal hacker, like with a meat cleaver, but I just mean like, you know, the actual like digital.
Oh yeah, definitely. We're not really like hacking the world, guys.
Right. Yeah. But you know, like if you look at so much technology from the typewriter, you know, the original patents for typewriters were as blind writing machines to, you know, the first LPs, like the long playing records were designed through AAFB and Robert Irwin, you know, working with Bell Labs to say like, okay, well, we want to make, you know, talking books more like, so we don't have to have like 100 records to have a novel on them. Like how can we cram more information onto this? And that's the first LPs, blind people were using them like a decade before sighted people were for that reason, you know, and there's example after example that I go into about that. And it all comes back to Melody, what you're saying, which is that, you know, yeah, we are the original life hackers. And that when you, you know, that's the definition, like ask any like Silicon Valley founder about what drives innovation, and it's constraint, right? It's like you're up against some problem, you have these tools, these resources, how do you fix it? And that's the disabled experience right there.
Well, you mentioned earlier like OCR, optical character recognition, and Kurzweil. You mentioned who's kind of prophetic person in the world talking about technology and you know, those things that we were thinking were helping us decades ago, right?
Is
a world that is just constantly scanning everything and translating everything. And it's interesting. I love some of the stuff you talk about in the book too, for folks that are reading it on just the tech side. You know, we run our Access World, which is a magazine around, you know, access technology and assistive technology and things like that, and dive into that stuff. And you did a great job, I think too, of just sort of talking about kind of the evolution as well. You know, with sort of some of the technology that's out there. You know, a thing I want to kind of, and as we're starting to move toward, you know, our third act of the podcast, if you will, is, you know, looking at how much has advanced over the past 10 years, right? Since you've really started this real diehard journey, right? Other than just knowing they had RP, but when things got, you know, things started to get real, you know?
Yeah.
What's happened this 10 years and just how everything's accelerating. And also, too, just with RP on the genetic side, right? You know, Foundation Fighting Blindness is, you know, posting stuff all the time. I read something this morning in Ophthalmology Times because that's a great read, you know, page turner. But, you know, but they're always doing something in terms of, you know, we're even if retinitis pigmentosa has some sort of solution that can render it mute.
Yeah.
What does that do to our culture?
Yeah.
What is the technology going to do to our culture too, where we all become Geordi from Star Trek, essentially? Probably sooner than we thought.
Yeah.
And, you know,
yeah.
Can you put on your visionary hat and think 20, 30 years from now?
Yeah. Or, you know, my visionary hat is actually called the Apple Vision Pro goggles that, you know, that Apple is making. Did you guys hear about these, like the augmented reality? No. But that's what I picture the visionary hat looking
like. A lot of us are thinking like this could be Geordi. Yeah.
Totally. I mean, it's weird because when I was researching the book, there was sort of, I really kept like a bright line between these two different categories of tech, where on the one hand you had things like screen readers and OCR, you know, and machine vision. And like, you know, this happened sort of after I finished the book, but I would certainly include like the Be My Eyes. It's not called the virtual volunteer anymore. What's it called? Like AI, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Be My AI. Yeah. Right. Where you can basically like point your phone, you know, just like, you know, point your phone at your fridge and it'll say you have seven bananas and two of them are moldy. you know, that stuff on the one hand, and then on the other hand, things like, you know, the Argus 2, which is like the retinal prosthesis where they, you know, implant a chip in your eye and that communicates wirelessly with a camera that artificially stimulates the retina. So even, you know, there's like sort of more recent versions of that where there's folks who have been blind from RP, you know, with very little, if any, light perception, who are suddenly like tracing a big white glowing X on a screen in a dark room. And it was striking to me because as I was sort of reporting and researching this stuff, like the screen reader stuff and the OCR stuff, I found so exciting and like just like geeking out about and wanting to like get my hands on it and figure out how to use it and like be a cool blind hacker info warrior dude. And then like the optogenetic stuff and like, you know, the sort of biomechanical interventions, the prosthetics in a word, turned me off completely. And I was just like, that bums me out. I always like imagined my son, who's 10, like, you know, his high school graduation as the sort of benchmark for like, you know, I'm probably going to be totally blind by then. And like, how will I experience that big milestone event? And like, for me, I was like, do I really want to be like RoboCop there, you know, and like seeing some weird, like, you know, prosthetic vision, or would I rather just be like hanging out, you know, and like maybe like hearing a description of it from Lily, my wife. And you know, it's hard for me to put myself in that position. And like, I'm sure I might feel differently when I'm actually doing it. But from where I'm sitting now, I find myself much more drawn to the kind of assistive technology than I do to the like cure technology, like the medical interventions that like will quote unquote cure blindness. And you know, we can talk more about like why I have those different feelings. But you know, for me, I think part of my journey in writing this book and just in becoming more blind is like, yeah, if like the good people at the Foundation Fighting Blindness like find a cure for RP, like more power to them. But like, you know, if I'm putting blindness charities in my will, like I'd much quicker to give my whatever is left to Bookshare so that like blind people can have access to books than to like, you know, try to find a cure for RP to the people who happen to have my genetic mutation.
It's kind of like we have to live in the now, right? And I think for me, you know, seeing all these things coming out, maybe that's just because I just had a whole new world of technology opened up to me these past 3 weeks, but and just a whole new mindset. I tend to agree with that. You know, I think there's things about even, you know, becoming blind. You know, back to what we original question I asked you is saying, okay, the Melody who had died, I think the Melody now is the same, but better in most respects, like, in understanding how to manage emotions, having to navigate the world. In more than that, just being so incredibly grateful for what I do have and knowing that people are in my life because they want to be, is just, it's, you know, it's been a wild ride. I mean, definitely don't get me wrong. You said that, like I said, the blind days are still there, but I think that there's a level of enhancement that comes with exactly everything that you're saying in your book, which I am really into, and I haven't finished it yet, but I'm on my way there.
Thanks. Yeah, no, I mean, you know, it's like important to also like point out, like, I'm not against cure, right?
Oh,
like,
me neither. Yeah.
And like, yeah, like if somebody said like, oh, here, just like take this pill or get this injection and like, you'll be fully sighted. Like, I don't think it would make a lot of sense for me to reject that. But
right.
You know, this is sort of like the sort of contradiction, or like the apparent, the seeming contradiction that we've been sort of circling around this whole conversation, which is like, they could both be true. Like you could accept the cure if one came along, but that doesn't mean that you're like living your life as a broken person,
right,
who just like is wandering the streets in like praying for a cure, and that until one comes, your life is incomplete. Like you can be complete in this moment and then like, hey, medical breakthrough, great.
Yes. And then you can take everything you've learned with you.
Would it be nice not to run into signs? Yes. But, you know,
go to a bathroom and not freak out.
Like, I mean, and just to complicate things further, you know, there are examples of very rare ones, but, you know, there's a wonderful book, if you guys haven't read it, called Crashing Through, about Mike May, who lost his sight as a kid and then lived basically his whole life, like grew up as a blind guy, and then had this experimental procedure that restored a lot of sight. And it is not at all clear at the end of that book that he's like better off for having the sight, or that he's happier, you know. And there's Oliver Sacks has written about this, other examples of folks who've been blind their whole lives who get their sight back, or who get sight for the first time. And it's like, what do I do with this? So they have trouble like telling men from women, and like shaving. Like there was a guy who was just like, you know what, it's so much easier to just shave the way I've always shaved, like turns the lights back off in the bathroom, because he is accustomed to being a blind person. You know, reading is super difficult. So it's like not at all as obvious as most sighted people assume it is, or even blind people, that like getting the vision is going to solve all the problems and make life easier. In some ways, like a blind brain is happier being blind.
There's no way I would ever drive a car, even if I No, not a fan. Oh man. Well, Andrew, this has been incredible. What's on your horizon as you're doing this, I guess a book tour. I know this will go out the last week of September. Yeah. You've been gaining huge traction. I mean, congratulations just on that.
Yes.
Thank you. Yeah. It's been really amazing just to see folks respond to it, and, you know, blind people and sighted people alike, I think, are like finding something in the book. So that's been like, you know, a writer's dream to have that kind of response.
All those news at McSweeney and everything else is just paying off, because you're, I don't know if it's your thinking like an editor when you write, but it's a great narrative arc and great information. So
thank you. Well, I had an editor of my own who helped me a lot with that. She really pushed me hard. I rewrote the book. You know, it took me like 3 years to get this thing done. So credit due to her as well. But I'm really glad you guys enjoyed it. And as far as what's next, you know, like while I was writing the book, I did a couple of freelance pieces. Like I wrote a piece about deafblind communication, and the emergence of this movement called ProTactile that these linguists at the University of Chicago are saying is actually like the world's first tactile language. And I did like a piece for Radiolab about disabled astronauts and the sort of like case for disabled astronauts with a really wonderful blind linguist named Sherry Wells Jensen. And, you know, doing stories like that, you know, and that story was, you know, Sherry's blind, but there was a bunch of other folks with different disabilities, and it made me excited about the possibilities of like being a journalist on the disability beat, and not just like doing sort of like breaking news stories about like legislation or, you know, like protests, but to really do like more like long form, immersive, deep dives into the issues that I kind of cover around blindness in the book, but like finding out where they exist in other corners of disability space, whether it's neurodivergence and autism or deaf blindness or deafness, you know, physical disabilities, mobility and disabilities, you know, all of that stuff is radically different from blindness, but also it's kind of fun to find the connections too. And so right now I'm sort of at the beginning stages of thinking about like what stories I might want to tell in that world.
Amazing. Well, it is blindness aside, and knowing that you're now the chief nerd on all things sight loss.
Yes.
On all things, what did you say?
Chief nerd on all things sight loss.
Sight loss. Yeah.
But no, it's just a great book. I'm like, I felt like I was reading something from the New Yorker, which is my go-to publication when I just,
awesome.
Good writer. Right. And so, you know, it's exciting. Anything you want to plug other than the book, any upcoming book tour dates or anything like that?
You can find those on my website, which is andrewleland.org. I have got a little events tab there, and I'm doing various things around the country in the coming year. Going to the Midwest in the spring, going to New York next week, probably two. I don't know how soon you'll be putting this out, but
last week of September. So
Oh, okay. Yeah. So yeah, October 4th, I'll be at NYU in New York. You can register for that on my website. But yeah, my website has whatever I'm up to latest, although I update it not as much as I should. But yeah, you can find all my social media through there. And my email address is on my website too. I've been getting lots of emails from cool blind people who are psyched to nerd out further about this stuff. So I invite anyone to drop me a line.
Thanks for nerding out with us today.
Yes.
Such a pleasure. Loved it.
I did too. It was good times. I'm going to keep going, but I know we all have to, you know, it's fun to get paid to do a podcast. So I have to say it's kind of fun to do that. Nerd out with people that make me smile.
Heck yeah.
Yes. Well, guys, thank you so much, Andrew. Thank you for being here with us today. And we are going to look forward to following you and keeping this up. And if you want to keep up with what we're doing at the American Foundation for the Blind, please visit www.afb.org. Thank you so much for being with us today. Have a good one, guys.
Yeah, you too. Thank you.
And thanks to Andrew for joining us for this episode of Inform and Connect podcast. You can learn more about Andrew and where he'll be by going to his website, andrewleland.org. You're listening to the Inform and Connect podcast, a production of the American Foundation for the Blind. Questions or comments on this episode? Email communications@afb.org. Feel free to visit our website as well, where you can make a donation to help support the work of AFB by going to afb.org/donate. AFB, creating a world of no limits.